I am here with Anne Applebaum. Anne, thanks for joining me again.
No, thanks for having me.
It's great to see you. Well, so you've just written a cover article in The Atlantic, currently titled online at least. I haven't seen the physical magazine, but the title online is The Most Nihilistic Conflict on Earth. This is recounting your two trips to Sudan, which has been plunged into yet another civil war. And I want to use it, as you do in the article, I want to use your experience of Sudan as a lens through which to look at the consequences of American retreat from the world, and this kind of general unraveling of the system of international law and international aid, which has really underpinned the what we have come to call the liberal world order for more or less as long as we've been alive, a little bit longer. So let's start with your experience in Sudan. What is happening in Sudan?
So Sudan is engulfed by a civil war. The two main warring parties, and actually there are several others as well, but the two main warring parties are formerly components of the Sudanese military. One part is the Sudanese Armed Forces, the kind of main part of the army, and the other is a group called the Rapid Support Forces, who older readers or older listeners, rather, will remember as the Janjaweed. Mm-hmm. This was a group that was created a couple of decades ago by a previous Sudanese dictator, and it was used as a force against, there's an ethnic conflict in Western Sudan between Arab-speaking nomads and non-Arabic farmers, very old conflict, resolved many times through intermarriage and so on, but in the modern era was juiced up by outside weapons, outside interests, and so on. And that's a kind of, that's more or less a broader version of that is what's happening now. But anyway, the Rapid Support Forces are the other group. They are fighting for control of territory. There's some other groups involved as well, but they're the main two groups. And the hard thing about the war and the thing that makes it hard for outsiders to understand is that it's not ideological. It's not a war of ideas. Mm. It's not clearly an ethnic war either. It's really a war between two groups who want power, who want money, who want control of territory, who want gold. There are big and important gold mines in Sudan, who want other kinds of resources, and who are not particularly concerned about Sudanese civilians. And the civilians have really borne the brunt of the war. I mean, it's, of course, always true that civilians bear the brunt of the war, but they're in the middle of the fighting and often the subject of the fighting in a way that's not always true in other places. So they're the focus of ethnic cleansing or of revenge or of, you know, they're particularly the Rapid Support, the RSF, as they're called, have quite a lot of mercenaries in their ranks who've been told that they won't be paid, but they can take whatever they can steal. And so mm-hmm. there's an immense amount of theft as well. So it's a very unusually ugly war. And I should say one other thing about it just at the beginning, which is one of the other things that makes it unusually ugly is the number of outside powers who have, who are contributing to it, who are buying weapons, selling weapons, trying to making deals with one side or the other, increasing the conflict. And they are include the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Turks, the Egyptians, the Iranians are there, the Russians are there on both sides, you know, and others. And none of them right now have any particular interest in ending the war. Instead, they're all seeing what they can get out of it. And that you know, in the way that the old conflict, you know, in Darfur was once juiced up by outsiders, this one really is too. And of course, now there are modern weapons, there are drones. The level of sophistication of the you know, the kind of violence that can be done is now just on a much different level than ever before.
Mm. Yeah, the list of outsiders from your article I found genuinely surprising. I mean, so you just listed some, but I'll just read you from your article. The Turkish, Egyptian, Saudi, Emirati, Qatari, Russian, Iranian, Ukrainian, Eritrean, Ethiopian, Kenyan, South Sudanese, Chad, Libya, Central African Republic, all, and the Chinese hovering in the background. I mean, maybe I don't know enough about the history of whatever the 500 civil wars that have been fought in the last 200 years, but that sounds like a pretty novel and awful contribution of outside powers.
There are really novel elements to it. I mean, the Ukrainians, for example, this is one of the big surprises for me. I have a special interest in Ukraine, and I told a Ukrainian friend of mine I was going there, and he sort of turned pale, and he said, oh, be really careful. you know, I know some people there, and I mean, and Ukrainians are there too, and they're there to kill Russians. So in a way, they're not there. They're not fighting on one side or the other. They're there attracted by the anarchy itself, you know, that this is a place where they can harm members. Basically, it's members of the Wagner group, that Russian mercenary group has had a long involvement in Sudan, and the Ukrainians attack them there. And so the fact that they're there, you know, is from pretty far away, tells you how much of a vacuum has been created by the war and by really, you know, and I'm sure this is the next question, by the absence of any outside power or organization or institutions who are able to help end it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so you just used the word anarchy. And as I was reading your article, it put me in mind of Robert Kaplan's very famous article from over 30 years ago, The Coming Anarchy, which was also in The Atlantic, I think probably the most read article for at least a decade in the magazine. And his prediction there, I think in the final analysis of did not come true. He was imagining the unraveling of international order and all of us being pitched into a kind of crime planet as a result. But in reading your article and in, you know, now posing the question I have to pose for you, I began to worry that you're, this is sort of an echo of his prediction there. And it's now we're on the cusp of something that is, of bearing out that prediction. Because, I mean, we really are witnessing just the consequences of a vacuum of leadership. And I mean, there's one quote from your article that really struck me as quite poignant and fairly arresting. I'll just read it to you because you say, a Middle Eastern ambassador in Port Sudan thought I was joking when I suggested that the U.S. might no longer care that much about Africa. That was beyond his imagination and beyond the imagination of many other people who still believe that someday, somehow, American diplomats are going to come back and make a difference. And I mean, that to me, that really speaks to the brand damage that our country has suffered. I mean, it seems to me Trump and Trumpism and this America first, know-nothingism has really, at least on the international stage, ruined the very idea of America. And so I just wanted you to just reflect on that and tell me what you noticed and what you continue to notice. I mean, you live overseas most of the time, so you have a very global view of our current moment in the States.
Yep, I'm in Poland right now, in fact. Yeah, I'll start with saying that Robert Kaplan, you know, I agree, the meltdown that he described didn't happen, but you can find on the planet now a number of places where, you know, there used to be order and there isn't now. Sudan is one. Libya, Yemen, Syria is on the cusp, could go one way or the other. And all these places are also places where this role of these so-called middle powers is very important, where there's no, you know, there's no U.S., there's no U.N., there's nobody else. And so you get these competition between other countries. And I would say that some of what people say about the U.S. is maybe even nostalgia for something that never was. I mean, it's more of an idea of America that there was such a thing as, I don't know, it's, you know, Camp David or, you know, the Dayton Agreement, you know, that there could be an America that would come in and bring all the warring parties and make them sit down at the table and have a conversation. I mean, maybe that didn't happen as much as people like to think. And maybe when it did happen, it didn't work as well as people remember. But there is it's almost it's kind of reflex. Like, when are they coming back and why have they gone? Mm-hmm. Of course, you do also increasingly have people who are angry or don't care or have tossed America into the group of, you know, sort of countries that are just as nihilistic and just as transactional as everybody else. And so, again, I don't know how much of the longing for a different America based on something real and based on an ideal, I don't know. But it is going to be gradually replaced by an idea that, oh, America's just another, you know, what's the difference between America and Saudi Arabia and Russia and Iran? I mean, they're all just a bunch of greedy transactional countries whose leaders are looking for personal wealth and, you know, who aren't really bothered about anybody's well-being. And, you know, I should say the United States, I mean, it's complicated because the United States has behaved badly in so many places over so many years, but it was always that the bad behavior was often balanced out by other things, by USAID, especially maybe by American health, you know, the contribution that Americans made to ending AIDS, to ending pandemics, working on Ebola, working on child health care all around the world. I mean, people knew all of that as America, too, whatever they thought of American foreign policy in any given moment. So there was an idea of American benevolence, you know, is, I think, really gone or is disappearing fast.
When I think about the damage to our reputation and just the failure of leadership, I'm thinking much more in terms of those ideals against which we measured ourselves, even in our failure. I mean, we do have a lot to apologize for in how we've behaved historically, but our failures have always been measured by the ideals that we really did stand for on our best days. I mean, like we you know, for as long as we've been alive, America could credibly be thought to care about whether other nations cared about human rights or, you know, through their journalists in prison or, you know, treated women like chattel. I mean, like those are, you know, we stood for something. But as you say, now we seem to stand, I mean, we seem to have announced to the world that none of that really matters. And we just want our president and his rapacious family to get a hotel deal in your capital city. I mean, so the corruption is not even hidden, and it's just been shamelessly advertised. And it makes me very sad to think that the ideals themselves now are understood, I think erroneously, but, you know, all too plausibly, they are understood to have been bogus this whole time. I mean, we are just like Saudi Arabia in some basic sense.
So one other thing that's happening, this wasn't the subject of this story, although it's something I am going to write about in the near future. The U.S. is also dismantling a lot of small institutions. This is much smaller than USAID, or trying to dismantle, I should say, because they're all fighting back. But the administration is trying to dismantle. For example, we have foreign broadcasters who broadcast in a lot of languages, you know, Russian, you know, many Central Asian languages, Chinese, the Uyghur language, actually, which almost nobody else broadcasts in, Arabic, obviously, Persian, and so on. And we have broadcasters, and a lot of them have real important followings, and they have listeners in around the world. And the Trump administration has been trying to cut them or trying to end them and their work for a long time. And, you know, for a lot of the world, that's how they know us. I mean, they listen to Radio Free Europe or Radio Liberty or Radio Farda or Radio Free Asia. And that's how they knew about America. And that's how they learned about us. And also that's how they learned alternative stories to the ones told them by their own propagandists, you know, by their own regimes. And they would listen to, you know, U.S. radio. And often it was, as I said, it was U.S.-backed radio, but the radios was done by nationals of those countries and those places. So it felt to them like had a local element as well. And a lot of it has already gone off the air, or there's already, because they've had cuts to their funding, that's been disappearing. And when that disappears, you know, it's not as if, you know, the U.S. stops doing that and nothing happens. You know, the U.S. will stop those broadcasts if that happens, which I hope it doesn't. And Chinese and Russian, you know, and Cuban and Iranian information will come and take their place. There isn't ever a vacuum, you know, in the world. I mean, the vacuum is always filled by somebody.
Right.
And there are already examples, for example, of Voice of America had a number of Chinese language programs that have disappeared to be replaced by Chinese state media. There was a specific example the Wall Street Journal found of, there was a Thai program that used material from Voice of America. Voice of America has now disappeared. That's been replaced by its Chinese equivalent. Over and over and over again, every time we disappear, the stories that we used to tell, the ideals that we used to have, we used to talk about, you know, the information that we were able to provide is simply gone. And so, and it's very ironic, given how many people who back this administration or claim to back it, who talk about fighting censorship and that they believe in free speech. And it may turn out, I mean, very soon, that one of the biggest impacts of this administration is to undermine and degrade people's ability to speak and to hear real information all around the world. So it's not just aid. It's also the end of those kinds of programs, the small small support that we often gave to democratic leaders and movements, but also to independent press, independent lawyers, all those things that were, again, really tiny amounts of money by compared to what we spend on the military or what we're about to spend on ICE. And cutting those means that people won't even hear about this democratic ideal or the free speech ideal anymore, because it simply won't be available to them. And the short-sightedness of that, you know, the lack of thought about what that means, you know, for the future, kind of flabbergasts me. You know, particularly given there's still China hawks kicking around, and there's still people in and around the White House, and certainly in Congress, who understand that the United States is in competition with other countries, not only economic competition and military competition, but also kind of war of ideas competition, and that the United States would just give that up is extraordinary. And I'm amazed there isn't louder reaction. I know that there's some in Congress are trying to help and trying to save some of these programs, but the administration seems to be not interested at all.
Mm. Well, you mentioned USAID. Can you tell me what has been the effect of Elon Musk's compassionate and judicious and technically agile editing of that program?
So what you need to understand about USAID is that it represented, aside from everything else, whatever else it did, it was about 40% of international humanitarian aid. That means food and medicine, basically. It's nothing else, no other programs, nothing. But it was also a huge part of the logistics. So, you know, trucking contracts to bring grain around the world, or shipping contracts, or statistics, or payment systems. And it, as it turned out, there were a lot of international organizations that were somehow dependent on them and those systems that didn't necessarily even know it. And so one of the things, even when I was in Sudan in the spring, which was a little bit after the disruption of USAID, is people were literally just discovering that they, you know, they had a budget cut, or some institution they were used to relying on was going offline. And you had this sense of this complete disruption. And remember that when USAID ended, it didn't end in a way that, you know, we passed on responsibilities to someone else, or, you know, wasteful programs were cut, but in a careful way so that programs that were useful were kept. No, it was shuttered. It was shut down. Yeah. I spoke to a woman, she's quoted in the article, who didn't want her name used because she's still technically there. She's still part of the humanitarian aid programs in the United States. And who said to me, when I talked to her in February, and she had been cut off from her email. She had been kicked out of her office. She had been cut off from payment systems. And she was personally responsible for a group of refugees. I won't say in which country. You know, and that was like her responsibility was to get food to them or get payments to them. And she was unable to do it. She didn't know what had happened. She didn't know where the money or the food was going. She had no ability to track it. And it just disappeared overnight. And the consequences of that, you know, the chaos, the canceled contracts, the expense, a colleague of mine at The Atlantic reported in the last couple of weeks, a story about a huge amount of nutritional food aid. There are these special products that are high calorie products that are made for people who are malnourished, that was in a warehouse. And because it hadn't been distributed, it was going to have to be destroyed. But of course, to destroy a warehouse full of food is also very expensive. So the cost of destroying it, the cost of this destruction, is going to be with us for a long time. And there were other very specific moments. I mean, I met a doctor who was using exactly some of this kind of nutritional aid food for the malnourished children in the hospital where he worked. And these were, I saw the children. I mean, they were tiny babies mostly. They were very weak. They were lying down. Their mothers were also famished and lying down, and they were in a hospital ward. And he was almost, you know, he was saying to me, don't worry, you know, we don't waste it. I mean, he'd heard that Elon Musk or somebody in America is worried that they're wasting this food. And he said, no, of course we don't waste it. We use it. And I had this feeling of shame, you know, that this man who's really on the front line of saving people's lives is justifying his use of, you know, of this product that Americans, you know, don't even care enough about to continue sending and would rather burn in a warehouse. I mean, it's a very dramatic moment. And people don't understand it either. They ask, you know, why? What's the reason? And it's very hard to explain, you know. why didn't you hand it off? Why didn't you, you know, if you didn't want, if you wanted to end it, why didn't you do it slowly? Why didn't you make sure nobody was going to starve or die because of what you're doing? And there's no explanation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hard-pressed to come up with any charitable framing of what happened. I mean, I think the obvious callousness and ruthlessness and even cruelty and, you know, jubilation with which it was, this vandalism was accomplished, you know, to, going on to X and saying, I spent the weekend feeding USAID into the wood chipper when I could have been going to great parties. I mean, just the gloating and calling all the people in the field who have given their life to this kind of work, criminals. I mean, it's just a completely psychopathic exercise in the destruction of American soft power. But if we were going to come up with some charitable version of skepticism about aid to Africa or to anywhere in the developing world, what would you say to someone who would say, listen, Africa has been, you know, many of these countries certainly have been basket cases for as long as I've been alive. We've been giving aid there at whatever level continuously. Maybe there's some set of incentives here that need to be reexamined. Maybe aid is not really as helpful as we imagine. Maybe what these countries need is a deal maker like Donald Trump to come in and, you know, privilege economic interests over handouts, and you figure out how to bring these countries into the 21st century under their own power in some sense. I mean, is there any, again, I'm casting straws here, but is there some version of skepticism that would kind of demand a reset of the status quo in this area that would be anything less than morally insane?
So you can meet people, and I know some of them, who worked at USAID and who've worked in the aid world and who would argue very strenuously for a different way of thinking about it, a different way of doing it. I mean, just for example, so in Sudan, one of the few really amazing positive stories is a movement called the Emergency Response Rooms, somewhat awkward name, but what it is a kind of Sudanese mutual aid organizations. And in a lot of cities, they've sprung up, they raised outside money, or they found access to food or medicine, and they created their own networks. This is after the war broke out, their own networks to help people and so on. And sometimes they had a little bit of money from the outside world, and some they raised themselves and so on. And there are, for example, ex-USAID people who think that that's the kind of, you know, organization we should help. So rather than helping, you know, large organizations or large charities or large, you know, these sometimes even for-profit companies who helped to move aid and food around the world, you know, it should have all been much more grassroots and local. So there's a version that would make that argument. But that wasn't what Elon Musk did. You know, what Elon Musk did was just blow up the whole thing, as I said, in ways that were disorienting and costly. You know, it's also, you know, it's not true that there's no progress. Actually, there's a lot of Africa that's better off than it was, and a lot of much of the rest of the world is more prosperous than it was, and lots of countries that were formerly consumers of aid, like, you know, India, aren't anymore. You know, so that it's not true that it doesn't work or doesn't help or it never changes or nothing ever alters. I mean, countries go up and down for different reasons. Sudan is a kind of, maybe is a special case because of the war. But also Sudan, you know, and one of the things I regret about the article and in some ways the story and the photographs and so on is that, you know, you can see in Sudan, you can see in Khartoum that there was a middle-class life there. I mean, there were apartment buildings and blocks and infrastructure and schools and universities. And I met a lot of people who had, young people who had been in university and studying something at the time the war broke out and then had to go home. I mean, it's not as if there was nothing. It's not, you know, or it's some primitive empty place. I mean, it's very rich in terms of culture and in terms of people are well educated. They speak excellent English. They know a lot about the outside world. You know, they're not as far away from us as we would like to imagine. And as I say, it's not clear that everything that we did there was a disaster and a catastrophe. But there were moments when the U.S. did help, and there was a big North-South civil war in the past. That was the old civil war,
yeah,
which did have a more, it had a more of a religious component because the North was Muslim and the South was Christian. And we did help to end that, and we were part of the South Sudan, which had been part of the same country. We were part of them breaking off and establishing themselves as an independent state. That's a longer story, but there is progress and things do improve. And, you know, it's just not true that, the kind of aid that I'm talking about is the aid that keeps people alive. So yeah. Nutritional supplements, medicine, things like that. And I don't see any good argument for ending that. I can see good arguments for finding ways to get it to people in better ways. I can imagine, you know, changing the way it was distributed, but to cut it off from one day to the next seems like it was impossibly cruel and pointless.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we have good intuitions for how societies unravel. I mean, this is a lot of your work is focusing on how precarious democracy is and, you know, what happens when democracies turn illiberal. And the potential for unraveling, even in American democracy, I think is, again, something that we don't have good intuitions for. I mean, we have this concept of a civil war. I mean, you're describing the civil war in Sudan, and you just distinguish between an older one and the current one. And in America, we have this phrase, the civil war. We think of the American Civil War as two armies meeting on a field, each representing, you know, half the country. But that's not the prototypical civil war. I mean, these countries dissolve into factions that where, you know, many, many different factions can be warring against all others and forming transient alliances. And I think we're paying a price for not having intuitions about this because we're not seeing how the loss of trust in institutions and the other signs that our commitment to democracy is eroding is putting us on this continuum of risk around the very real possibility of a fragmentation of our society. I don't know what you think the state of American democracy is at this moment. I'd love to hear that. But it's obvious to me that the signs of a fundamental breakdown in political legitimacy are there for us, right? They've been introduced. Yep. And that's a precursor to the unimaginably nightmarish things, you know, we've seen in societies like the one you just visited. And it really is just it's a matter of degree. And when things begin to unravel, it's just you no longer have the tools by which to put the society back together, right? I mean, suddenly the game theoretically, everything is different, and it's very hard to get out of that well of attraction and get to a higher place on the political landscape, and it can take generations. And we know a lot about how civil wars start at this point. I mean, again, I think there's been something like 500 in the last 200 years that have been studied, and it has to do with, it's not under, you know, a healthy democracy, and it's not under a secure autocracy that the risk is highest. It's when you begin to slide into the middle of the continuum between the two and experience something like an illiberal democracy where the trust in law and order and institutions breaks down, and you have strong factions that begin to vie for political legitimacy against one another, not abiding by any of the norms that keep our healthy democracy intact.
So I would say two things. I would say, one, I think you're right that Americans have trouble imagining change that, you know, that could be very dramatic. And I have lived in places where there has been change. Sudan is a really extreme example, but I lived in Poland when there was a good change from communism to democracy. And I also spent a lot of time in Russia over the last 20 years and watched Russia go from something that felt like stable and hopeful and possible to really a very centralized, ugly dictatorship, and in ways that people didn't imagine before it started. And I don't think Americans are good at imagining what would happen if we didn't have legitimate elections. You know, what would happen if some parts of the country start saying, why should we pay federal taxes? I've been watching really carefully the gerrymandering argument that's starting in Texas. And it's interesting for a number of reasons. One is because, in a way, gerrymandering is the ultimate failure of democracy. I mean, if you tried to draw borders of electoral districts in such a way that you know who will win, and you succeed in doing that, then what you create is, whether it's local state legislators or members of Congress, you create people who owe nothing to their constituents. The only election that matters for them is the primary, which is when the most extreme, you know, when the base votes. Mm. And then once they, because they know they'll win the general election, and then they don't have to worry about their constituents anymore. And they don't have to care about people who didn't vote for them. And they don't have to worry about people whose views are in the middle or anything else. So you create a different kind of politician by doing that. And also right now, the cynicism with which Texas is saying, we need 5 more Republican members of Congress. And so we're going to change the borders in a way that's out of line with the way it's done. Usually it's done every 10 years. They're doing this at an unusual timing in order to help the president. The president has stepped in and said, we deserve 5. We won big in Texas. We deserve to have 5 more members of Congress from Texas. I mean, this is a violation of the spirit of democracy in a way that, you know, we're now all used to hearing this kind of stuff. But if you take a step back and think about it, what they're saying is, we should be able to determine who's a member of Congress, not the voters. The response also of California, of the governor of California and other and one or two other Democratic states, which is perfectly understandable, by the way, saying, if you do this, we're going to do it too, which is, you know, we're going to change the borders. We're going to redraw the districts in California so that we get more Democrats. I mean, this is setting up a very ugly kind of competition, you know, which states can be more undemocratic than the next state. Yeah. And you will begin to have elections that feel fake or manipulated or not real. I mean, if you know what the outcome is of every election, then why bother to vote? And how does that reflect anybody's feelings? And how does it represent any kind of popular will? And also, I could be wrong about this, but the U.S. is either the only or one of the only democracies where someone other than an independent electoral commission draws these kinds of borders. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know in the UK it's done by an electoral commission. It's not done by, you know, by politicians. And so this, you know, it's a flaw in our democracy, and it's getting worse. And it also shows another possibility, which is that, as I said, states begin to see themselves as not really part of the same nation. I mean, if California's views on the environment and on, you know, social issues and maybe even on the economy and other things are so radically different from Washington, might there not be a moment when the people of California say, we don't want to be part of this anymore? Yeah. I mean, we're not going to pay, you know, why should California send any tax money to fund these red states, you know, whose values we don't agree with? I mean, you could imagine this Texas doing the same thing under President Kamala Harris or, I don't know, President Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez mm-hmm. or whoever is coming in the future.
That would do it.
You know, yeah. And so it becomes actually a lot easier to imagine than it used to be. And it's a kind of a different scenario from the Civil War, but it begins to have that effect. I mean, once the federal government is seen as not just, we don't like the person who's the president right now, but we know we can win next time. Once it's seen as really alien, you know, or once it's rigged in such a way that, like, we can't ever win there, then why should you be part of it? I mean, and then you could get a disintegration doesn't necessarily have to take the form of what we think of as a civil war. It doesn't look like the movies. But it would be a kind of dysfunction that would be very, very hard to get out of. Mm. And I feel we could be closer to that than we have allowed ourselves to think.
What has been most shocking to you so far in the second Trump term in the last, you know, 7+ months?
I think first of all, the speed has been very surprising. I mean, almost everything that the administration is doing is things I expected them to do. I expected them to go after universities, and I expected them to, you know, I expected them to try to control the media and so on. But I was surprised by how fast it went. And I was also surprised by how cowardly people are. Mm-hmm. You know, CEOs of major world-class companies who are themselves billionaires need to suck up to Donald Trump, you know, or, you know, people at very successful Wall Street law firms or people who run, you know, the big companies that own the big, you know, CBS. I mean, I didn't expect fear and cowardice from those kinds of people. Yeah. I think that's been a big surprise. I mean, I would expect it, you know, I don't know, maybe lower down, but actually lower down, I mean, there have actually been quite a lot of brave people. I mean, the breakup of USAID, there were a lot of people who protested and a lot of people who tried to stop it. A lot of people who risked their jobs or lost their jobs trying to block things. I mean, there are a lot of people, you know, lots of pieces of federal system who are launching lawsuits and who are fighting back. And I see them doing it, mm-hmm. but I don't see people, for the most part, there are a few exceptions, at the top doing it. And that surprises me. I mean, Americans?
You're telling me you doubt that Melania's scintillating memoir was worth $40 million to bring to film?
For example.
Yeah.
For example. And also the way senior Republicans, senators, and congressmen feel they have to suck up to Donald Trump and, say obsequious things about it. I mean, that doesn't seem very American. I mean, we never had that before.
Yeah.
When George W. Bush was president, was the Republican Party kind of falling on their feet to say what a genius he was? No. And I find all of that creepy. And I don't know where, I'm not quite sure where in the culture it's coming from, this kind of desire to submit or be, to subjugate yourself to some leader cult.
Yeah, the cultic features of it is, they're genuinely surprising. Again, I'm like you, I'm mystified as to how that schema gets booted up among otherwise psychologically normal people who many of whom were on record disparaging Trump and seeing him clearly, like seeing him as a con man, seeing him as somebody who knew nothing about running a great company, much less a great country, right? I mean, like these are people who would have admitted that there was no Fortune 500 company that would have hired him as a CEO. And through the whole process of campaigning against him, we have all these, the great clips of people like Rubio and Lindsey Graham and all of them just disparaged him endlessly and accurately. And how these people move into this new space of obsequious courtiership to somebody that that they look down on, to see one person do it is, it would be abject and amazing, but to see basically the entire Republican Party do it, but for a few defectors, sociologically, it's a kind of just an astonishing social phenomenon.
Yeah, I actually wrote an article during the first Trump administration about exactly this. It was about collusion and, why people collaborate with things they know to be wrong.
Yeah.
Basically, that was it. And there were a lot, the article had lots of explanations and there's comment, some people are ambitious and some people are craven and some people are greedy and some people have this idea that if I just stay on the inside, I'll be able to get something done. Mm. But, they have this idea of their own importance and so on. And I had all these reasons and stories, and actually the article starts with a long soliloquy about two East Germans, one of whom famously left the party and one of whom famously stayed and became head of the Foreign Secret Service. And, some of the articles about the difference between them. And so I'm actually someone who spent a lot of time thinking about it. And even I, who did think about it before and have thought about how it works in other countries and other times and other places, and mystified by the scale of it.
Yeah.
We are not living in a police state, actually. You aren't going to go to jail for disagreeing with Donald Trump. This isn't Russia. It isn't China. It isn't North Korea. The penalties for crossing the president still aren't that great by world historical standards, by the comparison to places where they would be great. And yet people are doing it. And I don't have the full understanding of yet. I mean, something has changed in the American psyche. I mean, maybe it was the fact that he was elected the second time. Mm. And that meant there had been a fundamental shift. I mean, maybe that's what people are feeling in Africa and elsewhere in the world, that it wasn't a temporary aberration, it's a fundamental shift. The international institutions that America once supported are now really gone. They're not just weak, they're finished. And maybe something like that is happening in the United States, where people just don't have any confidence anymore that there'll be, there's a normal to return to.
Yeah, the moment when he said that, when he blamed Ukraine for starting the war with Russia, I went back and looked at the video. It really seemed like he just blurted that out by accident. That didn't seem to be something he actually thought before he said it. He just sort of stumbled into it in a kind of word salad fashion. But once he said it, he doubled down on it, and everyone was left trying to make sense of it. And just to see people, again, who know the truth, try to make the rational case that Ukraine had actually started the war, or to just try to pirouette around the president's, you know, patently insane statement without disavowing it. It served as an amazing loyalty test, right? It's just like you have to pretend to believe the unbelievable to be in this cult, to be in good standing in this cult. But it was amazing to see.
No, I had this conversation with people a lot of Europeans, for example, on the tariffs, this, you know, the mad tariffs, you know, one day it's 20%, one next day it's 40%, next day, you know, they want there to be some kind of logic to it, right? So they're all looking for, how do we return to some kind of institutional relationship with the United States? You know, what's the logic of this? How do we follow the logic? What do we do? And what they can't wrap their minds around is that there isn't a logic, you know, and there isn't a strategy. And Trump doesn't think strategically. You know, he thinks within any given moment, am I winning?
Right.
Is this, in this conversation with Zelensky, am I winning the conversation? In this conversation with the British Prime Minister about tariffs, am I winning there? You know, am I winning with India over, you know, he's not thinking about all the things you've just been talking about, America's reputation, you know, soft power, the long-term effect, you know, what will this do to the economy in 3 years or 5 years? He's not interested in any of that and isn't and doesn't care. And so what you're seeing is him, whatever he feels is the right thing to do in that moment. And that and people who aren't used to that and who aren't used to an American president who thinks like that just don't get it. I mean, they keep waiting for the evidence of the three-dimensional chess game,
yeah,
you know, or the secret strategy that will reveal itself. And then it doesn't come and they feel confused. But I think it's we haven't had that kind of leadership before ever, or certainly not in modern times or in any president of the last 100 years. And so adjusting to it, that may be also a part of the explanation for people's weird behavior, is that everybody's looking for a way to work with someone who is, you know, doesn't think about the future, doesn't have a plan, doesn't have a strategy, and is simply saying what comes into his head at any given moment.
Mm. But what do you think the aftermath of this will be? I mean, when the Republican Party, should the Republican Party wake up to itself and realize how distorted it got by Trumpism? I mean, it's in the aftermath of Trump, when Trump leaves office or dies, presumably we'll have a normal president in the next term or the term after that. What, in the aftermath of all of this, do you think there's just going to be a, you know, stipulate that we return to something recognizable and normal in American politics? Is there just going to be a great forgetting of how weird things got? Or is there going to be some kind of acknowledgement of the principles that deranged us and some sort of attempt to safeguard the norms that have been restored?
You know, what worries me is something I've seen in one or two people I know, which is that once you have accepted, once you voted for Trump or decided you were backing Trump, or certainly once you've decided to work for Trump, if you're a thinking person, and many of them are, you know that you're doing something bad. In other words, you know that if you're working for him on tariffs, you know the tariffs are crazy. You know, if you're enabling his, you know, his constant flip-flops on Russia and Ukraine, then you know you're part of that too. And one of the things I'm worried about is that a lot of people will almost double down. They'll find a reason to excuse it or explain it. They'll go on defending it. They won't want to ever say that it was a mistake, because if they say that it was a mistake, then that says something very bad about them.
Yeah.
And I worry a lot about the Republican Party, even in the near future, not being able to let it go, or having this, you know, the famous thing about, you know, the second generations of communists who would say, you know, the ideas were good, it was the people who failed, you know. So there will be MAGA people. The MAGA idea was correct, but these mistakes were made, and now we have to do MAGA the right way, you know, like they kept trying to do communism the right way. So that worries me, that I don't know that they will be able to look back and say, I mean, of course, you know, this is a very cliche thing, but a lot depends on what happens. I mean, is there an economic crash? You know, are we unlucky, and are dismantling of some of our intelligence networks, does that result in some kind of catastrophe? You know, so a lot depends on whether the risks that we're now taking come through. And that will, of course, affect how people remember this era. But I, you know, if you look at human nature, and people actually pretty rarely regret or take back, you know, their involvement in something that they knew at the time was wrong. Instead, they look for ways to explain it or justify it. And I think that could happen.
Well, what's your view of J.D. Vance? Let's assume he's the successor to MAGA. How sinister a figure is he? And I mean, he strikes me as quite different from Trump. I mean, Trump is, you know, I think of Trump as, I've said this before, you know, that he's effectively like an evil Chauncey Gardner character. You know, like Chauncey Gardner, the character from Being There, was perceived to be this oracular genius because he was actually fairly dim-witted, but he, because of the context he was in, his very simple-minded utterances got accepted as just one profundity after the next because he was in this novel political context. And I view Trump as, you know, it's not that he has no talents, but his shamelessness, his total lack of compunction, the fact that you can never possibly accuse him of hypocrisy because he doesn't even aspire to be a good person. And then he absolves everyone else around him of their sins. He's like forgive me if you've heard this before, but I mean, I compared him to Jesus, but he's grabbed them by the pussy Jesus. He's fat Jesus. He's, I'll eat whatever the fuck I want Jesus, right? So the one thing he can never do is judge you, really, because he's a walk-in absolution of everyone's fear about their own hypocrisy or their own mediocrity. But J.D. Vance strikes me as someone who knew which way was up at some point in his life. And now he, for opportunistic reasons, and maybe, Frank, you know, sincerely ideological reasons, he is tacked into some weirdly quasi-authoritarian space. How would you view the prospects of a President Vance?
I should first say that my colleague George Packer at The Atlantic wrote a great piece about J.D. Vance a couple months ago, which I recommend. Mm-hmm. I haven't met him myself or spent any time with him, so I don't have I don't have that kind of insight. I would say that the thing that scares me about Vance is that he feels to me or looks to me like a kind of classic chameleon. You know, he takes on the values of whoever he's around. Mm. You know, when he was at Yale Law School, he was a beloved figure among the Yale Law School liberals. You know, when he moved into Silicon Valley, he, you know, absorbed the values of that group. You know, now he's in the MAGA movement and he's parroting, you know, what they say. And, you know, and that makes me worry that there isn't a deeper J.D. Vance. I mean, there isn't a kind of someone who can stand from the distance and say, you know, this is wrong, right? You know, there's no deeper conscience or morality. I mean, and that's very dangerous because that means he's very cynical.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
You can imagine him, you know, a President J.D. Vance, you know, deepening, for example, the corruption of the Trump era, you know, finding ways to institutionalize it, to make people wealthy who are useful to him. I mean, this is what happens in authoritarian regimes, right? You get the corruption becomes the system. You know, you become a kleptocracy. And we're not that yet. It's all still very haphazard and so on. But you could imagine someone like Vance deciding that was, you know, the most useful path for him. I mean, I suppose the curious thing for Vance, about Vance, and this is what George wrote, is whether he's at all interested in anymore in the people who he claimed to represent and to be coming from, mm-hmm. and whose name he sometimes speak, you know, the people of Southern Ohio or Kentucky, where his family is from, because much of what this administration is doing is going to harm those people. Right. You know, it's going to take away their health care. It's going to wreck companies that they work for. It's going to make the environment that they live in dirtier. All kinds of things are going to happen because of that. And so will that ever become some kind of contradiction for him? Will he ever think, you know, I've abandoned my people? You know, I just don't know him. But I worry about people who are that cynical. And as I said, the danger with him would be making this haphazard, random, whimsical stuff, that he would make it permanent. And that would be the great danger.
All right, so Ann, final question. This is a lateral move, but it's connected through the career of Trump. I want to get your thoughts on the global explosion of anti-Semitism we've seen since October 7th. You can add your thoughts to about the war in Gaza as well. But of the more thoughtful people I know who supported Trump and to some degree still do, I know a fair number of people who are effectively single-issue voters who looked at Kamala Harris and what she was unable to say about the conflict in the Middle East. And they said, all right, I'm going to roll the dice with Trump. He's been, you know, he moved the embassy to Jerusalem. He may be crazy. He may be transactional, but his crazy and his transactionalism has heretofore been aligned with Israel's interests more often than not. And, you know, Kamala Harris couldn't have been relied upon given how entangled she was with the left wing of the Democratic Party.
Despite her Jewish husband.
Exactly. Yeah, that too. But so, and thus far it has, you know, that has been borne out to some considerable degree. I mean, up to the moment we bombed Iran, I mean, that was something that you could be fairly doubtful that Kamala Harris would have done as president. So, and both on the left and the right of our politics, if you move far enough, you are guaranteed to meet fairly committed and vociferous anti-Semites of different flavors. And it's, at this point, just unignorable. I mean, certainly if you're online, the level of ambient anti-Semitism and conspiracy thinking and, you know, the status of Israel as effectively as a pariah state now is just fairly unignorable. What are your thoughts on this moment, you know, globally, and you can take any side of it you want?
Right. Well, there are many different strands there. Maybe for context, so I'm in Poland now. I've lived here on and off for 30 years. My husband is a Polish politician. And we are experiencing here a wave of mainstream anti-Semitism of a kind that I've never seen. Mm-hmm. And I should say, I know nobody will believe me, but actually, anti-Semitism was not part of Polish mainstream politics for most of the last 30 years since the fall of communism. And it just wasn't really acceptable. I mean, people, of course, there were anti-Semites and there's historical stuff, and we wouldn't have to go into that. But it wasn't allowed in the main, you know, it wasn't what people voted for. And we now have an actual anti-Semite who wins votes. We now have open anti-Semites on the internet. I'm of Jewish origin, and I am now attacked in a way that never happened to me before. It even happened in the last few days in a quite a public way. And I honestly believe that a lot of it is coming from Twitter, from X, and coming from the fact that the people see it now online, especially on American social media that's coming from the United States in a way that they never did before. I mean, it was considered sort of socially unacceptable or politically unacceptable, and yet now here it is, it's allowed. And I do think it's one of the ways in which U.S. social media, I won't say this is coming from the American government because that would be unfair, is making, you know, it's sort of made legitimate or made okay to say things that weren't possible in the past. So that's one thing to say. The second thing is, you know, I don't know if in your last question on the show you want to talk about Israel. I mean, Israel, I think it's possible to be appalled by October the 7th and fully supportive of Israel's right to fight against Hamas. It's also possible to be horrified, and this is in reference to our earlier conversation about breakdown of norms and so on, by the signs of starvation and violence in Gaza that now seem to be directed at people who are just trying to get food and stay alive. And it feels to me like it should be possible to, you know, to criticize Israel on those grounds without it devolving into anti-Semitism or some argument about anti-Semitism. So you can see, you know, Israel has made the events over the last couple of years have made it very hard even to have normal and direct and clear conversations about Israel. And that's partly because of anti-Semitism on the left and partly because of anti-Semitism on the right and partly because the Israelis themselves will now simply accuse any critic of being, for any reason, of being anti-Semitic. So that's that doesn't help the situation.
I would add, Anne, I'm sure you're going to agree with this, but it's additionally possible to criticize Netanyahu and even just reject him as a viable political figure, and certainly to criticize his alliance with the far right, people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, and acknowledge how distorting all of that is, you know, their millenarian lunacy is for the, in terms of finding moral high ground over there. You can bracket all of that and still understand the need to defeat Hamas and groups like Hamas.
I understand the need to defeat Hamas, but the, you know, remember that the greatest critics of Netanyahu and the people who are most upset actually about what's happening in Gaza are in Israel. You know, there have been recent statements by former heads of the IDF and Shin Bet and, you know,
yeah,
and Ehud Barak and many others. You know, so there's nothing anti-Semitic about saying that. And yet somehow that conversation has got bogged down you know, in the same muddle, yeah. which I find disturbing and upsetting. The third thing I'd like to say is that the idea that there are Americans whose main reason for voting for Trump was because of his policy to Israel, you know, that they're one issue voters who are mostly interested about what happens in another country also bothers me.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, if you're American and you're voting for an American president, then you should be concerned about the future of Americans, and you should be responsible enough not to put someone with autocratic tendencies, not to vote for someone, you know, who carried out an assault on the Capitol. It seems to me that those things should matter more to you than what his policy is towards whether the Israeli capital is in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. And I also know some of those people, and I've had conversations with them, and I'm mystified by it. I mean, I just don't get it. You know, I don't think that when you're selecting an American president, that should be your main criteria. I mean, I don't think anybody should be a one-issue voter. You know, you should be thinking about what's the good of the nation. And then, you know, finally, and maybe related to the first point, you know, there is something profound that's changed in what we feel able and allowed to say about Jews, you know, about people of different races, about, you know, the crudity and violence of language that you now encounter regularly, just if you're on Instagram, you know, or on Twitter, or watching YouTube, or watching TikTok. I mean, I think it's coarsening everybody. I mean, it surely is the background to what explains why people felt it was okay to vote for Donald Trump as well. You know, so it isn't just anti-Semitism. It's a broader issue. Yeah. It's the spread of conspiracy thinking. Jews are always the focus of every conspiracy theory, including the Epstein conspiracy theory. Mm. You know, it's the spread of tribalism that is encouraged by this, you know, this sense that there are people who are in our country who don't belong here and who we need to organize to hate. And, you know, there's a deeper ground that it's part of. You know, I'm not sure that I would attribute it to the left or to the right, but more to the kind of decaying centrist culture. I mean, another good article actually happens to have also been in The Atlantic, I think a year or so ago, by Frank Foer, who wrote about the moment in American history that was especially good for Jews. He meant the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When the U.S. was focused on the ideals we were talking about, that it was that we were a democracy, we had equal rights and civil rights. You know, anybody could be American if they played by the rules and were a good citizen and voted and took part in politics and so on. That was a moment that was really good for people who were Jewish or anybody who, you know, who came to the country from the outside. And that moment may now be deteriorating. And as we lose our respect for centrist institutions and as the things that held us together fall apart, I mean, it's going to be, you know, you'll get an explosion of anti-Semitism and other isms all across the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Anne, it's always an education. Someday we're going to have to find something we really disagree about.
I'm sure there's something.
I hear my wiser, more informed self whenever I talk to you. So thank you again for coming on, and thank you for everything you're doing. And again, I recommend that people read your cover article in the current issue of The Atlantic, which was quite eye-opening and ominous and well worth the time. So thanks again, Anne.
Thanks for having me.